You're listening to Architecture Masters.
I thought I'm going to the University of Greenwich, Maritime Greenwich, yes, London. But I remember getting on a train at Charing Cross and the train just carried on. And before I knew it, I was in the countryside. I'm like, where is this going? But actually, the School of Architecture was out in Kent. So for 3 years, you know, we were out in Kent studying architecture and then, you know, making trips, you know, weekend trips.
Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture, with me, Owen Wainhouse.
My name is Rashid Ali. I'm the founder of Rashid Ali Architects. Yeah, I mean, I discovered this incredible kind of layers and layers of buildings in Mogadishu, in the Somali capital, that very little has been kind of written about, that's in dilapidated kind of conditions. And I, in some way, that kind of re-established my connection to the country, and but also to reflect on the concept of kind of heritage preservation, because there's not much discourse, not just within that particular city, but across Africa, about the value of historical buildings. Really incredible to think that the Italians, young Italian architects, were going to places like Eritrea and to Somalia to make these incredible architectural experimentations. Yeah.
Our guest this week is the architect Rashid Ali. Rashid grew up in Hargeisa in northern Somalia, and then in Manchester in northern England. He went on to study architecture at Greenwich University and at the Bartlett School of Architecture in London. He subsequently worked for Karakuzovic Carson Architects and then at Adjei Associates. After 5 years at Adjei Associates, he left to pursue a number of other projects, including teaching, research, architecture and urbanism, all encompassed by his practice, RA Projects. The practice, now known as Rashid Ali Architects, works on a range of scales and typologies, from one-off houses to cultural centres and exhibition design, and also research work in Somalia and across Africa. Rashid was shortlisted for the Young Architect of the Year Award in 2008 and again in 2011. In this week's episode, we discuss the practice's work on Finn House in London for fashion designer Roxanda Ilnik. We talk about the difficulties and benefits of balancing teaching with practice, as well as the practice's increasing work back in Hargeisa in Somalia. I first met Rashid when his practice, then known as RA Projects, took a place in the Reba Incubator for Emerging Practices, which I had just launched. I started this week by asking Rashid what's in a name and how RA Projects became Rashid Ali Architects.
Yes, I worked for a long time in practice, and in particular with David Adjei, where I had really great experience and learned a great deal working with him. And when I left there, it was never really to set up a practice as such. It was more like a little kind of a sabbatical, and to teach and to think. Yeah. And then after a while, you realize, you know, talking about architecture is very much about making. Making is an integral part of it. Yeah. And I wasn't, you know, I didn't do it with the intention of being an academic. So while I was doing that, small projects kind of came about, and really you just wanted to practice. You didn't really want to think too much about the name of the practice as such. So I saw them as small projects which were part of, which was the particular activities of other things, of course, teaching and research. Yeah. There were these three things that overlapped. So I just thought, yeah, it's, you know, Rashid Ali Projects. And and since then, it's
kind of broader thing encompassing lots of different things rather than
absolutely.
Just,
yeah. I think that overlap between, particularly in between those three things, research, practice, and teaching, they're interdependent.
Yeah.
And for me, in terms of architectural kind of production, the other two things are really... are really important.
Done a lot of exhibition kind of work and installation work, different scale of work to, I guess, some of the bigger stuff. What sort of work were you doing at Adjei? What were the kind of projects?
I think what was really fun about working at the practice at the time when David set up the practice back in 2000 was the multi-scale approach, and that's something that I've carried through into my practice. You know, on the practice, you're working on a particular detail or component of a big public project with a group of other people. And at the same time, you're doing a small exhibition by yourself, or maybe a small residential project, or maybe a piece of furniture. So that multi-scalar approach of working, you know, project of different scales was really enjoyable, and it's something that I'd like to do as much as possible.
And that
possible.
Was something that came out of working at AJ?
Yes, yes. Yes, and I think, of course, that practice has moved on since, but I think... you know, collaborations and multi-scalar approach to making architecture is still something
that
they do.
That was 2002.
AJ Associates founded in...
2000, I believe.
Okay, so you joined fairly early.
I was still doing my part two at the Bartlett when I started to...
So what sort of size, if they were kind of a couple of years old, what sort of size of the practice when
I
you started?
I think at that time they were about... six, seven of us, you know, we were all kind of sat in the same room and had conversations and made tea for each other.
Yeah.
So it's quite an interesting
nice
experience.
Nice to be in at the kind of founding, or essentially, yes, not long after the founding of a practice.
Completely, and I think it was always, it was fun to work directly, you know, with David Ajay, who I still know and talk to about my own work. So, it was really great experience, yes.
Remember any of the kind of projects you were working on then? Were they?
Yes, I think some of the key projects from that was the Idea Store libraries. I think I was still doing my part two when the practice won the competition to design those two libraries for Thai Hamlets.
Yeah.
And it's a very small practice. We started to work, you know, from small residential projects to big public projects for the public sector. Yeah. So, and then I also was lucky enough to work on Rivington Place, which is the gallery project for the Institute of International Visual Arts and Ineva. Yeah.
So it must have been you must have seen the process kind of 4 years then grow. Do you know what size they are now? I mean, one gets the impression they're a kind of huge,
I mean, it's a practice with different offices across the world now.
Yeah.
I believe there's a big practice as big as London now in New York.
Yeah.
And there's a practice also in Ghana as well, in Accra.
Okay.
There's one in Berlin.
Yeah.
So what's really interesting is a lot of the people that are working in these practices that have set up the practices in different parts of the world are people that I used to work with.
Right, okay.
And we still kind of retain a kind of relationship, you know, which is
really positive.
Which is great, yes.
Yeah. So we're going to jump around a little bit then. But so you were born in London.
I was actually born in Somalia, in Somalia's second biggest city in the late 80s. The family moved to Manchester, and that's where I grew up in Manchester and came to study architecture in London.
So you moved at what age?
I believe I was 11.
Okay.
Yeah.
So old enough to be conscious of the move and to remember.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. So it's Hargeisa, was it Hargeisa?
Hargeisa is the second city of Somalia, yes.
Okay. Yeah. And so your parents moved. What was the kind of rationale?
I think it was really a combination of things. I mean, first and foremost, you know, it was about education. So they wanted us to have a great education, and the family historically had a link to the UK because that part of Somalia used to be a British colony, and we had relatives here.
Right.
But mostly it was to get a great education, and that's the reason. And also there was kind of. The country was slowly becoming a bit unstable politically, so it was
kind of safer.
It was for those reasons. Yes, yeah.
And are they? I'm always interested in people's kind of route into architecture. Your parents aren't architects.
No, they're not. They're not architects. In fact, I'm the first, you know, person to go to university within in my family. For them, about coming here was really, you know, about going to university and getting a great education. And you know, when we arrived as kids, that was something that was always instilled in us, you know. You've got to take your education very seriously, and you know, it's quite normal. Immigrant families, that's what they tell their children. that was the case with my family. Yes.
And so you came with brothers and sisters.
Yes.
What was the kind of family setup?
I mean, we're a large family.
Okay.
There were nine of us.
Wow.
I think there were two sisters older than me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
you're the only one to go on to be an architect.
I'm the only one that went on to be an architect. Yeah, yeah. I think it wasn't really a kind of a conscious plan thing, really. I mean, I just, you know, the earliest memories of kind of the decision to go into architecture, I remember, was that my parents always used to say, you know, you're gonna, you know, rebuild your country, and yes, you should do civil engineering and and so on. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like a great thing. For me, it was, you know, it was, as a child, it was always very important that I enjoy the things that I do, and I realized architecture would be kind of much more fun.
Yeah.
Than civil engineering, so that's how I switched. Yeah.
Right. So we'll come on to the switch kind of as we kind of move through. But then, quite a change from Somalia to Manchester.
Yes.
You know, kind of culturally, climatically, you know, all the. So you settled in Manchester, and then I guess at age 11 went to school.
Yeah.
In Manchester.
Yes, I remember it very clearly. Came to the UK. I think it was around October time. It was incredibly cold. It was raining, yeah. as Manchester is famous for. And I think within a few days went to school, without speaking a word of English. It was you know, as a child at the time, it was like, oh, it's scary, you know.
But at 11, I mean, it's quite late, yeah. I guess, to then pick up another language.
Yes, but I think as a kid, you don't really think too much about it.
No.
And as long as you kind of, you know, make friends on the playground and you're comfortable, then you're not really too conscious about your kind of your language limitations.
Right.
So it was, you know, pretty smooth kind of process.
Okay.
Yeah.
So mother tongue is
Somali.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is a language spoken across the Horn of Africa.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
In Ethiopia, Kenya, Somali, and so on.
Yeah. And so learning English then at school, was that just, I mean, was there the kind of structured English teaching, or how did you, was it just learning by osmosis, you know, that?
It was a combination of both. Obviously, the structured learning in the school, but also in school, you know, having no choice.
Yeah.
You just got to have to communicate the best way that you can. And also making an effort, the family made an effort to speak English at home as much as possible,
right,
okay. So that, you know, that really helped.
All the kids would learn quickly.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah.
And then do you remember that's, I guess, age 11 is secondary school.
Yes.
Do you remember the kind of thinking about architecture then, thinking about the kind of, you know, was art a big thing? Was, you know, what was the kind of influences that...
I think if I just go back a little bit, when I was in primary school back in Somalia, I mean, of course, it's a context where kind of this kind of limitations. So you might get, you know, one kind of book, for, you know, to share between kind of students, for, you know, one of these sort of exercise books, if you like. And often, you know, it might be science, and then there's lots of little diagrams of kind of... creatures and insects and you know, these little biological diagrams that you see in books, and I used to draw them really incredibly well, and I used to really enjoy it. So in some ways, that's the earliest kind of memory. On the other hand, of course, you know, art is part of the regular kind of curriculum, and I used to, you know, without, you know, a lot of kind of training, I used to really enjoy drawing, and it was almost kind of effortless.
Right.
And also, there used to be, and I think, I suppose they now have different name, but there used to be a subject called craft design and technology, which is very much about making, that kind of technology and drawing and making and so on. And I used to really love that subject.
Right.
It was a workshop context.
Yeah.
You know, you put on your jacket, your overall, and, you know, you came into the class to make things.
There's a kind of formality to it.
Exactly. And I used to love it.
Right.
That was the one subject that I just couldn't wait, you know, during the weekend. It's like Monday, I'm going to class and I'm going to be making my clock or my chair or my table and so on. So that, in a way, that's where it all kind of, started, this idea of kind of working with my hands and designing and making things.
Right, okay. And then the drawing came on, I guess.
Yeah, it was, it was sort of part of that process. So in some ways, it's about kind of bringing together this idea of you know, having natural skills to draw, but also really enjoying and making things.
And then, so I guess you kind of go through secondary school and have to start thinking about A-levels.
Yes.
Do you do A-levels?
Actually, I didn't do A-levels. I mean, I had all the GCSEs that I, you know, too. But somehow I was instilled, or this idea of doing engineering was instilled in me. So I was like, well, I want to become really specific, so I want to prepare myself for civil engineering. So I did one of these vocational programs or courses that is actually civil engineering at that level.
Right, okay.
And I went on to do that. And it, while I was kind of doing that and doing it relatively successfully, that I realized, you know, maybe this is not for me. And then I thought, well, actually, what can I do, you know? Yeah. I like designing. I like somehow making kind of spaces and objects and so on.
So it was really, even until then, the kind of civil engineering was almost the route being kind of opened up for
Yeah, me. Exactly. And I began to have conversations with my tutors and so on. And then that's when I decided architecture. Interestingly enough, I don't know whether they still do them, but while I was still in school, there was this test that used to be done where you feed loads of questions into a computer and then it prints possible...
Yeah. I think I got told I'd be a bin man or something. I think that was my outcome.
And actually, it came up with an architect. And what architect? I never really took it seriously. It came up with a set designer, and I was like, "What is that about?" You know. And it's quite interesting to think back to that. You know, 4 or 5 years later, I think, maybe there was
something
there.
Okay. How long was the vocational course, the engineering?
2 years.
2 years. Yes. Don't you think that's quite an interesting background for an architect now to have had that early engineering background? Has that kind of been helpful in the kind of grand scheme of your work now, or is it just a distraction in terms of the...
I mean, it helped in the sense that I was... you know, very competent technically.
Yeah.
So, of course, when...
You didn't have any of these sky hooks. Really kind of...
And, I mean, there was a continuation of that making, because there was an element of making and going to the outdoors and checking sites and so on. But also, when you come to the School of Architecture, I mean, you know, you don't really have any technical skills. So for me to produce technical drawings and details and so on was
really
a lot
helpful.
Easier. Yeah, it was really helpful. Okay. Yes, yeah.
And so... you then decided on a BA in architecture.
Yes.
Moved to London.
Yes.
First time moving to London.
Yes, it was, strangely, I never wanted to come to London. You know, I was quite, you know, comfortable locally. You've got your kind of network of friends, family, and so on. And I think, you know, having taught, you know, architecture, I think at that time it was a bit rigid in terms of the backgrounds of people that they take. So it was always like standard A levels. And I think back then there was an emphasis on science and physics and maths. This is kind of mid to late 90s in a way. So it was a bit complicated
to get
into the, you know, the local schools of architecture that I would like to have gone. And Greenwich, University of Greenwich, which was, you know, quite good at the time, offered me a place, and you know, I just thought, you know, let's go for it. It's going to be an adventure. You know, go to London and so on. So, and it's been, you know, in life you don't really, you know, it's not always about the decisions that you make. You know, sometimes decisions that are made for you, you know, work out best, and it was really a fantastic decision. Yeah, that's informed the rest of my career anyway, and my interests.
That was made for you.
That was made for me.
And it's Greenwich. People talk about, I mean, we'll come on to your teaching now as a, we'll come on to your teaching a little bit later on, but different universities are known for different, I guess, within the architectural profession, specialisms are kind of known for different things.
Yes.
Is Greenwich, just maybe say a few words about the kind of teaching in Greenwich, or about, you know, is it a kind of very technical university in the way that things are taught, or is it a kind of very artistic course?
I think things change over time, and this is when I started going back, I think it's a little over 20 years ago now. Time flies. But at that time, it was really creative place. It was really a fantastic place to study. And, you know, I had no knowledge of that when I went there, but a lot of really fantastic young architects who have now made, you know, gone on to make a name for themselves were teaching. Yeah. You know, they were based in London and going out there. And a lot of practices that you'd know now, you know, as young, they were going out there as young tutors to teach. So it was a fantastic place. I mean, it was really so much, it was more about the school itself, the School of Architecture, rather than the kind of wider university. But I mean, for me, Greenwich, I thought I'm going to the University of Greenwich, Maritime Greenwich, yes, London. But I remember getting on a train at Charing Cross and the train just carrying on. And before I knew it, I was in the countryside. I'm like, where is this going?
Yeah.
But actually the School of Architecture was out in Kent.
Right.
So for 3 years, you know, we were out in Kent studying architecture and then, you know, making trips, you know, weekend trips and to study, you know, to visit London and to socialize, but also to you know, for study trips and so on.
Okay. And then
I did my part two at the Bartlett.
Just around
the corner.
Oh, yeah, UCL. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. I mean, the Bartlett.
And was that straight on then, straight after? Did you take a year out?
I took a year out and worked with a practice now. It had a different name back then, but now it's called Karakusevich Carson.
Oh, yeah.
Quite well known for social housing.
Yeah.
And there was that interest even at that time, I think 1999, 2000, in social housing, but we were still, you know, doing, you know, back extensions and so on.
Okay, again, a smaller practice at the time.
There was, you know, 3-4 of us, and we were all, apart from the Paul Karakusevich, the principal, the rest of us were graduates from that same class in that year at Greenwich.
Right. Okay.
So it was just a bit like reforming the unit within an architectural practice setting. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Paul hadn't taught there then. How did you kind of?
He actually taught he was my tutor at Greenwich.
Right. Okay.
Yes. And people like.
So the tutor picks the decent students and hires them afterwards.
That's what you do all the time. That's what I do right now. Yeah. There were a lot of really fantastic young architects teaching there. Paul Karakusevich was teaching there. Sam Jacobs was teaching there. Okay. The rest of the FAT crew or practice were teaching us, such as Charles Holland and so on. Yes.
Yeah. We should explain FAT for people listening.
Fashion, architecture, taste, well-known young practice from the 90s and noughties. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And then to the Bartlett, I guess, you know, one of the kind of most prestigious architecture schools in the UK.
Yes.
And that's.
I mean, in some ways, a lot of people go into a career, in my case, in architecture, not really quite, I mean, you know, it's about experiencing the education. That's when you really know when it's for you.
Yeah.
And this is the reason why a large percentage of graduates from architecture don't pursue a career in architecture. But for me, it was just an incredible experience. I loved making spaces and thinking about spaces and about making spaces. So, of course, you want to work with the best and you want to be taught by the best.
Yeah.
So even though I was incredibly lucky to have been taught by really very talented people at my undergraduate level, you know, the Bartlett was always the place, along with perhaps one or two other schools in London.
Yeah.
That's where you want to study.
Yeah.
So it was really just a natural progression if you had some ambitions of kind of, you know, making progress in terms of your thinking and having and engaging with people that are doing really great work and thinking about fantastic ideas.
And then kind of interest, do you think some of that, you're talking earlier about the craft design turn technology classes, was some of that then coming in that kind of early influence?
Yeah.
Or was it more abstract?
I think in a school of architecture, and particularly at the Bartlett, you're always making things. So there's always an element of kind of, you know, thinking about ideas, representing them, and making. But actually, it was incredibly conceptual. It was just really about ideas that were often quite kind of abstract. And for me, that wasn't, I mean, 2 years is a long time in your architectural education, but for me, that wasn't really an issue because I had a technical background and you know, through my initial kind of education prior to coming to architecture, but also my undergraduate and also my year out, I was fairly competent at technically, if you like, detailing and representing ideas. So for me, it was just a really nice experience just to dive in and to think for 2 years just about ideas.
And of course,
you know, there is a lot of kind of discussions about, you know, what kind of education should students come out with from School of Architecture. I mean, there's been recent discussions about, you know, the fact that students don't have enough skills when they come into the practice and so on. But I think across the 5 years, as long as there's a balance and you have some experience and learning of every aspect of it, then that's fine. So, but to answer your question, I really enjoyed, you know, pursuing ideas rigorously on a more conceptual level.
Yeah. And that kind of, talking about conceptual level then, you've clearly enjoyed or thought a lot about that kind of education process because you're now, you've taught for a number of years, a number of different universities.
Yes.
That I'm kind of really interested in that architectural education. And I say for me, I don't have any architectural education, but my university, I studied science, and the kind of teaching is often by generally a kind of elderly professor who comes in and imparts their knowledge to you and clearly knows a lot about a subject, but maybe doesn't know a lot about teaching a subject and how a subject is taught. My kind of impression of architecture is there's often younger lecturers, you know, closer to the age of the students they're teaching. Perhaps learning with the students, perhaps, yeah, it's a different style of teaching, really, different kind of approach to education. I'm interested in your thoughts.
I think you're right in a way. I mean, just from my experience, I never went in there as the master, the person that knows everything.
Yeah.
So there is an element of kind of co-learning. Of course, you have certain kind of interests with which you want to kind of explore with the students and to push them in a way. But I think for me, it was important to kind of expose students to as much as possible. That was really always the kind of fundamental thing, and then to help them or to guide them through it, especially the you know, particularly the technical aspects of it, you know, to do with kind of, you know, approach to materials and so on. But one thing that I've always said to students was that, you know, it really doesn't matter whether you will become an architect. I mean, I always encourage them to be. You don't want there's a lot of money invested in architecture now, so you know, you don't want to
be fairly serious.
You've got to be a little bit delicate.
Yeah.
But I always felt that architecture is a great education anyway. So they should really enjoy it. And be incredibly rigorous in terms of exploring and coming up with ideas. And enjoying was a very important thing for me. You know, I said to students, you know, this is, you've got this luxury of thinking about ideas on a conceptual level, you know, for 3 years or 2 years and so on, and you should really enjoy it.
So interesting then, some people, when they finish their architectural education, go off into a practice, maybe a big practice, or just kind of focus on delivering huge buildings and delivering. That's clearly not a route you've decided to take in terms of just purely kind of commercial heavy workload. So you clearly want, you know, there's something there about exploring ideas and quite, you kind of think about that, kind of use the word kind of conceptual, but there's clearly a lot of research and kind of ideas that you're wanting to explore, I guess, both in your work in architecture schools, but also in the practice.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's, people have different kind of interests, different qualities, different attributes. And I think the route that I've taken was always kind of, you know, in response to my own kind of interests and my own skills in a way, I think to go to a big commercial practice and to make progress in terms of career ladder, you need kind of whether you enjoy it or not, you need project management skills. Yeah. And often you're managing the project itself rather than focusing on the kind of idea. So for me, I always like to work on the whole kind of a process, particularly on the creative kind of aspect of it. And you know, ideas in some ways are transferable. Yeah. So for me, you know, you could be working on a piece of furniture or just a kind of a facade detail, or you know, objects or spaces of, you know, modest kind of scales. Yeah. And those ideas somehow conceptually can be transferable. So it really didn't matter as long as I'm exploring the ideas that are of interest, you know, also with clients often that you work and collaborate with. It's equally as valuable as working on a, you know, £50 million project in the City of London.
And then, so teaching, saying earlier, teaching now at UEL, but for, what's that, four years, but Liverpool, Oxford Brookes, Cardiff, Nottingham.
I'm no longer teaching at UEL.
Oh, okay, so you finished it at UEL, so UEL, Liverpool, Oxford Brookes, Nottingham, Cardiff.
Yes.
Number of architecture schools on different modules, different, you know, teaching a similar subject. What's the kind of
there is obviously the studio system, which is the common approach to teaching design in the UK. So my emphasis has always been mostly on studio teaching, teaching students design essentially. But obviously, you know, over a period of time, because of my experience, you know, it's also about how you can't think about projects just on a conceptual level. You have to, at some point, think about the technical aspects of it, what's its material kind of treatment and so on. So, you know, for me, it's always been really important to think about how, you know, how theory can feed and develop these projects, how you can think about it on a technical level. And once you have a little bit of experience as a practitioner for some time, then you are able to kind of assist students and to talk to them about the technical aspects of making architecture.
And it's that kind of studio teaching you enjoy, is it, more than the kind of stand in front of a group and deliver a lecture?
Yes, I mean, I think that's where my kind of strength is as an architect. So I've always taught studio design, and not just really, not just making theoretical projects as you do at the university, but also actually making physical projects, building actually projects with students, hands-on making.
Yeah. And that maybe then brings us on to some of the work for Rashid Ali Architects and, you know, I guess, kind of RA projects before. And the kind of, so I guess a lot of the work is kind of a boundary between architecture and art, maybe quite a kind of,
and I mean, I think just to go back to that conversation we had about the Bartlett, was that actually that's where, if you can think of influences as such, influences to my approach to thinking and making architecture began. And I think a lot of the references that I began to look at that time were visual culture and specifically fine art. And I think, you know, there's lots of different things that could influence, you know, a project. There are things that you're thinking about continuously. There are, you know, certain moments that inspire a project. It could be about the site. But you'd be quite right in saying that fine art is really strong influence in the way that I think about project. And sometimes, you know, sometimes the influence is very obvious. Sometimes it's quite subtle. Sometimes it's about a detail, sometimes it's about the overall spatial and material kind of form and presence of the project within the city itself.
I mean, I was thinking about the kind of Roksande, the Serbian, British Serbian fashion designer.
Yes.
Is that how you say her name, Roksande?
Roksande Lincic.
Okay. Yeah. Featured in wallpaper. It's kind of quite a kind of sculptural kind of quality there. I mean, it's a sort of residential project and a kind of, let's say it's quite sculptural, quite a kind of artistic angle, really.
Yes, I think I mean, of course, you're always working and collaborating with clients. So first and foremost, it's about, you know, the functional needs, because you're working in spaces people will live. But at the same time, for me, it's, you know, it's always important to make some kind of a gesture, in the sense that if you look at the project as a whole, there's always something that's visually striking. Yeah. And in a way, that's what that project was about. It's really a refit of an existing house, and, you know, from basement all the way up to the first floor. And it was just really about making a piece of sculpture, a functional piece of sculpture that runs through the whole house.
Okay.
And that's really striking, and that's, you know, very visible visually. So that's what the stairs that run through this house with a striking kind of blue, which in a way sort of also references some of the color palette of her collections.
Right.
It was very much about working with that. It's interesting. I mean, it's a big, you know, it's, in a way, there's a lot of design that's gone into different aspects of the house itself. But every time that I had a conversation with somebody, you know, the blue stairs, very nice. And I was like, thank you very much. But it's not just blue stairs. Yeah, it's not just blue stairs. But it's, you know, it's always nice when something that you spent a lot of time with and thought about, you know, regardless of how they articulate it, that people kind of notice it. And that was the nice thing about it. And it was really...
I suppose that comes down a little bit to the kind of language of architecture, and, you know, blue stairs is quite an easy thing to articulate in English, whereas the kind of, you know, modern minimalism or something in the rest of the house is slightly more difficult.
I think it's the kind of ordinary way. I find it quite funny.
Yeah.
And it's quite nice to have a conversation on that, on that level. And yeah, I mean, people have, call me and say, oh, that, you know, really striking color, can you give me the code, you
know? Like a Pantene code and so then a kind of range of, you've done a bit of residential work in London, and kind of a few other kind of housing projects, but increasingly now spending time back in Hargeisa. What was the kind of, what drew you back, what was the, in terms of
I think I did this research project on modernist symbols in Somalia back in 2012. It began actually at the London Festival of Architecture. It was shown at the London Festival of Architecture, called Forgotten Pasts and Distant Futures. And then again, there was another iteration of it that was shown at the Dakar Biennale and also in the US. So... I discovered this incredible kind of layers and layers of buildings in Mogadishu, in the Somali capital, that very little has been kind of written about, that's in dilapidated kind of conditions. And I, in some way, that kind of reestablished my connection to the country and also the region.
Did you travel back much then as a child? Did you travel?
Really. I think the first time I traveled was in 2013.
Okay.
So it's not really.
So a long break from the country.
Yeah. And I think that's when I began to think, you know, it's a really interesting context to maybe think about, you know, new ideas in terms of, you know, working on the ground, but also to reflect on the concept of kind of heritage preservation, because there's not much discourse, not just within that particular city, but across Africa, about the value of historical buildings.
Yeah. And is the building stock then in, you talked earlier about the kind of British influence, is it a lot of the building stock date back to kind of colonial times, or what are the buildings?
Yeah, there's a mixture of, I mean, obviously, the country as a whole, especially coastal areas, have always had historical interactions across the sea through trade and so on. So there's a mixture of influences and layers over time. There's the there's the colonial influences, such as, you know, the Italian, the British, the Arab kind of influences is also there, particularly along the coast, because there's always been a trading link.
Yeah.
So also as far as India and Persia as well.
Yeah.
So there's a mixture of styles, but there's a number of really important buildings, in my view, on an within internationally that have rarely been documented. Some of them have been built after independence, and some were built by the Italians in the 1920s and 30s.
There's a kind of mix of some of the kind of what sort of Art Deco.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yeah. There's some really, I mean, you know, again, the history of modernism in this country goes.
Yeah.
It doesn't really go. It goes back to the 30s, really, and it's really incredible to think that the Italians, young Italian architects, were going to places like Eritrea, and to Somalia to make these incredible architectural experimentations.
Yeah. And is the country? I mean, talking about kind of going back now, is the country still open to, you know, are there opportunities for young architects now? I mean, is that one of the things that appeals about doing work?
Yeah, I think in southern Somalia, it's a little bit more delicate because it's not quite, there's still kind of security issues.
Yeah.
But in the north, which is a kind of semi-autonomous region known as Somaliland, there's an incredible boom. There's, you know, the main cities are massive kind of construction sites, but very little, unfortunately, very little of it is informed by design culture.
Yeah.
So for me, when I go there, it's really about starting a broader public discourse about the role of design and how through this you can make better city spaces and better buildings, essentially.
Yeah.
So rather than going there to, as an architect, and say, yes, I'm here, you know, hire me,
give me some work.
Hire me. It's really about much more talking about ideas through public kind of forums.
Okay.
And we're in the process of setting up platforms to begin to talk about architecture at a local level, to talk about the local context historically, but also to establish kind of links, because ideas, you know, it's always about linkages as well.
Yeah.
So to, you know, to bring people, you know, from other places, you know, locally, you know, regionally and globally, to begin to share ideas.
Okay. Yeah. So we've got some other podcasts coming up shortly with, I think, Nairobi Design Week and various other people we've been talking to in Kenya. And interested, really, I mean, you mentioned the word design, the kind of crossover between design and architecture.
Mm.
And often design is still very strong, you know, in terms of fashion and fabric. And, you know, is there a strong kind of design ethos? I mean, are people, in terms of getting people to think about architecture, are you starting from actually a kind of design literate audience thinking about fashion or about music or about other forms of kind of creative?
Yeah, I think in an ideal scenario, you want to be thinking about all of these things and think about the kind of relationships. But I think you also have to, in that particular context, you have to think about what's really tangible.
Yeah.
What will people kind of respond to initially?
Yeah.
So at the beginning, you might just talk about spaces and then relate that to local techniques of making, making both in terms of buildings, but also making kind of furniture, because there are small kind of crafts workshops that make very distinctive local kind of furniture, and of course people might prefer to have, you know, chairs from China these days, you know, because in a way, you know, cheap manufacturing from other parts of the world is killing local kind of craft.
Yeah.
But for me, it's about the emphasizing the value of that local making and that local tradition, but also to begin to think about, oh, well, how can we work with designers to do, you know, to make something even more kind of interesting using those techniques and skills.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that's interesting then, that talking about working with local designers, I guess large parts of Africa are kind of getting Chinese investment at the moment in terms of infrastructure spending, kind of construction on buildings. Is there much of a Chinese influence at the moment in Somalia?
I mean, it's coming. It's really coming. I mean, you know, Somalia, and particularly the north of the country, is obviously Ethiopia's next door, and Ethiopia is becoming a massive kind of manufacturing hub. Cost of production in China is rising, and a lot of manufacturers are relocating to places in Africa, and such as countries such as Ethiopia, because there's an incentive that the government is kind of offering for land and so on. And that, you know, those goods that are manufactured have to go somewhere. And of course, at the beginning, they were coming from all the way from China. So now they will, they will be exported, to countries in the whole kind of, in the whole region. But I think for me, the really critical thing is not just about cheap manufacturing and cheap products, but also how could we work, I mean, spatially on an architectural level, is about how do we make cities kind of new city spaces that complement existing kind of context, because the existing city spaces are distinctive and are unique, you know. So it's about how the two complement one another, and in terms of thinking about objects and other smaller kind of products and so on, I think is, you know, the question is, you know, do you just kind of download files of furniture and objects and just manufacture them in this setting, or do you say, well, actually, how do we work with local designers to again make something unique and something that's local? Because I think that would add an incredible value to whatever you're producing, whether you're making city spaces or whether you're making furniture.
We're interested in talking about kind of city spaces and kind of maybe on sort of master planning ideas. I guess one of the concerns in kind of bigger African cities, you know, Johannesburg and maybe Nairobi, is that I guess because of security situations, people end up living slightly more in suburban kind of compound areas where you maybe then lack a kind of public space and a kind of area for interaction that, you know, older cities have still kept. Is there that trend, do you think?
I mean, that's a really huge issue in big cities in Africa. I mean, people are beginning to, and you know, for the last 10 years, have beginning to live in gated communities. And a lot of the investors and the developers, they're making housing projects that are gated, which I don't think it's a great model for great cities. But I think this is what this kind of this idea of having a discussion about the quality of city spaces is about. I think there are precedents. You know, there's been cities such as Medellin where there's been incredible security issues, much more worse in some ways at its peak than a lot of African cities. That's completely transformed itself. And that has happened by really making intensive investment in low-income communities and low-income city spaces. So instead of investing a lot of capital in prestigious city spaces, you know, the spaces that when you might visit in Nairobi or when you might see social media images of Nairobi, instead of those spaces, make an investment in terms of making public spaces in communities that need it. And I think that then that begins to address these issues about kind of security, because the local people, they will value that investment, you know.
And then I guess kind of interested in future of Rashid Ali Architects and kind of projects coming up, and what's the kind of, you talking a lot about kind of ideas and about research and about, you know, almost kind of leads into kind of think tank ideas and things. Is that the kind of future, or is bigger kind of built projects or discussion forums, or we're talking about design weeks and design festivals and things? What's the kind of,
for me, it's really fundamental that you know, making buildings and making spaces and thinking about ideas, it has some impact. That's really important. I mean, I love working in London. and it's a great city, but sometimes there's something, as an architect, who's always thinking about ideas, there's something frustrating about investing so much energy in a back extension, in a small private residential kind of project. I mean, in a very small area just outside this building, you know, you can get data from the last 100 years, yeah. You know, in drawings and photographs and so on. And that's not the same, obviously, in other parts of the world, in the global south, and specifically in Africa, where I'm interested in. So in a way, that drives this kind of engagement with Africa and African cities, and specifically in East Africa. So I've been thinking about ways of, you know, getting the public to engage about the role of design in city making, so that, you know, then this begins to have an impact on the quality of lives of its inhabitants. So there are two projects that are in the pipeline that I'm developing at the moment, and I've been researching on. One of them is to set up a school of architecture or architecture institute that really deals with issues, with local issues, very contextual kind of based. And of course, this raises the issue of architectural education, which we talked about earlier on, yeah. And thinking about what's the model, mm-hmm. what's the really appropriate model mm-hmm. for that particular kind of context. Architectural education is very expensive. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is to set up a design forum, which in a way, I mean, you know, London Festival of Architecture is great. It's also it's inspiring to see all of these things, all of these debates, all of these discussions in 1 month. So it's also to set up a very kind of a modest design festival called Design Hargeisa. And I call it Design Hargeisa rather than, you know, Architecture Biennale, because yeah. I want it to be a bit more broad, to be a bit more kind of open to all disciplines mm-hmm. within design. And, you know, there is a young population, you know, in many parts of the continent and the region, you know, 70% of the, you know, of the population are less than 30 years old. Yeah. I'm very conscious of this issue of, you know, migration, you know, across the Mediterranean, young people just, you know, leaving. Often they have skills. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the issue of kind of entrepreneurship and job creation is an integral part of both, you know, the design forum and also the School of Architecture. Because when you graduate from the School of Architecture, you know, in many parts of Africa, in many cities, you can't just do your CV and send it to 100 practices. It just doesn't work like that. The practices don't exist quite often. The whole process is driven by developers yeah. and engineers. Structural engineers do a lot of the work. So it's getting them to be kind of entrepreneurial and yeah. to get them to be facilitators and initiators of ideas. Yeah. And I think a lot of that lies in working with communities. You know, one thing we're great at as architects is coming up with ideas. But it's about being innovative and creative in how to make those ideas happen, yeah. how to implement them, yeah. rather than the traditional approach of, you know, architect, client. Yeah. You know, I need a client, you know, to to make a project happen. Yes.
A lot of architects, I guess, in London now, some of the kind of innovative architects acting as their own developer yeah. and kind of that entrepreneurial zeal.
Yes, completely.
Is that, I mean, just kind of interesting, is that something you're able to teach in the university setting? How do you kind of encourage students?
I think it begins with making a very strong sustainable link with communities. Often communities that have needs, whether it's about you know, quality of public spaces, or whether it's about educational spaces, whether it's about social spaces and so on. But of course also you can't avoid capital. So it's also about collaborating with the public, with the private sector. You know, there's a lot of capital now in the economies are kind of growing. GDP is growing in many parts of the continent. So, you know, it's also about collaborating with the private sector and saying, you know, it's really worthwhile making investment in certain parts of the city and with communities that have a need, and everyone will ultimately benefit from that, and it will really transform the perception and the experience of the city, yeah. you know, in the long term.
And then I guess just kind of starting to round up, I'm kind of interested in, I guess it's always like, it's funny talking to architects much later on in their career and yeah. kind of looking back in hindsight at how they've the decisions they made and the kind of agonizing over, am I going to carry on teaching? Am I going to, am I going to leave a practice? Am I going to stay in a practice? Am I going to be an employee, you know, an employee or an employer? You know, how am I going to kind of, at what stage? And battle for everyone, I think, going through those.
yeah, I think for me, actually, when I was the incubator, it was, by the way, it's a great thing. I really, really enjoyed it. In some ways, I said to myself, damn, I didn't make use of it as much as I would. I would have liked. And it was very much to do with the fact that I was teaching full time.
Yeah.
That was
yeah.
the first job, and I think also alongside with Liverpool, where I taught full time.
Yeah.
And then it sort of coincided with the face, because, you know, you have faces in your architectural career, you know, and because you have different interests and you're in different part of your life, you have family sometimes and so on. So it also coincided with the time when I had this urge to kind of practice, to produce more. So I used to, you know, talk to the guys whinging. And I'm sure I said to you that sometimes, oh, I want to quit teaching. I want to cut it down to one day a week. So that there's all these things that are happening so that we can, I can make kind of time for it. But I think, you know, I think one, you know, to have engagement with students and with the School of Architecture, you know, 1-2 days a week minimum, it's great, and it really informs and invigorates the way that you think in practice.
It's an energy in it, I guess, that comes out
completely. Yeah. And I think all of these guys that I know that I was referring to earlier on, who have taught me, you know, they've gone through the same path. They were doing exhibitions. I mean, FAT were doing exhibitions. That's what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I think, of course, it kind of, it gives you confidence, you know, and it's, I think it's a great thing. I mean, anyone that enjoys architectural practice, I would always recommend do some teaching, you know.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Really, really enjoyed it,
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Rashid Ali. You can find out more about Rashid and his work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Twitter. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. If you've enjoyed the programme, why not leave a review or a rating with your podcast provider, as this helps others to discover the programme. You've been listening to the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.